Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Florida against Royer.
Boy, what an emergency. Hey, Billy, that's
like this was King,
King against Smith.
Was that the name?
That's the name.
King?
King against Smith. That was that famous
that was the one that
man
the,
in the house.
That Earl won.
Man in the house, and had a big debate about whether we would ever make it justiciable. We ought to just get, say, primary jurisdiction in the grantors.
Yeah, but what was the one that followed John Rowan?
Oh, yeah, that was at New York.
I can't find it anywhere.
Yeah, well, I can tell you what it is. But that followed inevitably from King and Smith.
That's right. But that also emphasizes
nevertheless, we would entertain the suit.
Yeah. But that was all in sanction.
Thanks, Dad.
Well, I don't know. I think they...
We've gone beyond that since.
Fox, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This is a petition to review the decision of the Florida Third District Court of Appeal, in which the Florida Third District Court of Appeal reversed both the appellate panel and the trial court upon their denial of the defendant's motion to suppress. The facts were extremely simple. The defendant was arrested at the Miami International Airport carrying 65 pounds of marijuana in his luggage. The state's witness, Detective Johnson, an experienced narcotics officer, testified generally as to his training in the profile, so-called DEA profile, and the fact that he observed thousands of passengers each week at the Miami International Airport, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. On January 3, 1978, about noon, the defendant appeared at the airport. Detective Johnson testified that in his experience and Detective Magdalena's experience, it was undeniable that the defendant's conduct and demeanor attracted their attention. The defendant was extremely nervous, pale, uneasy, looking about, and Detective Johnson testified that in his experience, the defendant was not a so-called white-knuckle flyer, but rather was concerned about being detected. The bags the defendant was carrying were very heavy. He had produced an extremely large roll of cash to pay for his ticket. The defendant was observed placing on the airline identification labels the name of Holt, and his ticket apparently was also in that name also. It was undisputed
below. He's putting these on his baggage, you say?
Yes, Your Honor.
When did the officer find out that he bought a one-way ticket, if that was the case?
When they examined his ticket and license upon request at the initial encounter with the defendant, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. It was undisputed, as a matter of fact, including through the defendant's testimony, that they approached him and asked him if he had a moment to talk, and he said, fine. The defendant himself testified that upon request...
Did they identify themselves at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. They identified themselves as narcotics officers, and may we speak with you a moment? Mm-hmm. The defendant himself testified that he voluntarily produced his ticket and his license for their examination. They immediately noticed the discrepancy between his ticket and the baggage and the license, and he explained that someone else had made the reservation for him. Johnson then told the defendant that they believed that he was carrying narcotics and would he come to a room a few feet away for further discussion. Johnson said the defendant was thoroughly cooperative throughout the transaction. The detectives were in plain clothes. They displayed no insignia. They carried weapons, but they were concealed. There's no showing in this record that they blocked his path in any way. They were courteous at all times. They did not threaten.
So what did he say when they asked it?
He followed them to the room.
He didn't say anything?
He did not say anything. He went with the room to them.
Well, did they indicate that he didn't need to go or not?
No, Your Honor, there is not a Mendenhall-type warning, if you will, in this circumstance. The defendant proceeded to the room, as did Sylvia Mendenhall, without discussion.
Mm-hmm. Who had possession of the ticket?
The ticket was evidently in Detective Johnson's possession at all times, but it was never
Once it was handed over.
Pardon me?
Once it was handed over. Did he hand it to the police?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. Yes. But the ticket actually never left the defendant's possession. It was always right there with him, with Detective Johnson, as they were carrying out the discussion and as they went to the adjacent room.
Wait a minute. You said never left his position. I thought he handed it to the detective.
Never left his presence. Excuse me, Your Honor.
No, but it was in the possession of the detective. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
So if he wanted to get on the airplane, he would have had a little difficulty.
He would first of all have to ask
to get the ticket back.
That's correct. Which he did not do in this case, of course. But there was also, as an indication of the nature of the transaction, the defendant indicated himself that he understood all that was going on and there was no physical contact at any time. Detective Johnson, I think important for this court's consideration here, testified that he wanted to go to the adjacent room to avoid any embarrassment to the defendant and to avoid any possible violence in the crowded airport area. In the room, which was 40 feet away, they again asked him if they could. They initially asked him for his consent to open his suitcase, and they told him again that they suspected him of transporting narcotics. In response, the defendant produced a key and locked
one of... Mr. Fox, let me ask you another question. You mentioned the violence concern that the officer expressed. Do you think the facts that were known to the officer at the time he requested the ticket would have justified a frisk of the passenger
with
weapons?
I think in view of the...
Did the officer frisk the passenger?
No, Your Honor. I think in view of the extremely agitated condition of the defendant, I think a frisk would have been appropriate, but was not done.
He was carrying two suitcases, was he?
Yes, Your Honor, two suitcases. One suitcase, he had the key, he unlocked it. The other suitcase, he did not have the key, but he said that they could go ahead and open it if they wanted to. And thereupon, they opened it, and it contained the marijuana. The entire transaction took 10 to 15 minutes. The initial approach took a matter of only a few minutes.
Well, suppose when they first stopped him, he had said, "No, I don't particularly care to talk to you. I don't particularly care to identify myself or hand you over my ticket." Would he have been free to go?
Detective Johnson specifically testified that when people refuse to talk to them, if they don't have enough facts, they let him go.
And if he had said, when they asked him to go into the other room, he had said, "No, I don't want to." The testimony is they would have let him go.
Yes, Your Honor, that's...
So he gets to the room and they say, "May we search your suitcase?" And he says, "No, you may not." What's the testimony about that?
There's no indication one way or the other, Your Honor. Now, I was asking...
Did the officers at any time tell him that he was free to go?
No, Your Honor, there was no specific advice.
Did they also tell him that it was free not to turn his ticket loose?
No, Your Honor, they did not specifically advise him of that.
And did they also tell him they didn't have to go to the room with him?
No, Your Honor, they did not specifically advise him of that.
They didn't tell him any of the no's, did they?
No, Your Honor, they did not.
They told him the do's.
Well, they asked him that these questions, Your Honor, and the trial court accepted that as a matter of fact, that in fact the transaction was totally voluntary.
Yeah, two armed men who say, "Would you mind coming along with me?"
Is there any evidence that he knew that they were armed?
And I mean, how many people do you know who wouldn't go?
Your Honor, I certainly wouldn't
go. Would you go?
No, Your Honor.
You wouldn't go?
No.
With two armed men?
I didn't know. I would not have known they were armed.
Have you ever tried it?
Pardon me?
Have you ever tried it?
I have been to the airport and made observations of
these fellows were in plain clothes, weren't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the fact that they were armed wasn't immediately evident.
It was not immediate.
I don't see how you can miss it.
But it was. But they did say they were narcotics agents.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that unarmed, that's rather rare, isn't it?
Your Honor,
would you, if you had been accosted and said, by two narcotics agents who identified themselves. Would you assume they were armed or not?
Was he with you?
Your Honor, I probably would assume they were armed.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Well, isn't it also true they showed him their badge?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And they also said they'd been expecting him, didn't they?
No, Your Honor, that was the defendant's testimony.
Oh, I see.
That was not accepted by the trial court in this case. Your Honor, with respect to the voluntary nature of this transaction, which seems to be the court's concern, we would submit that there was evidence, which the trial court chose to believe in this case, that the transaction was a voluntary transaction. The defendant was a 22-year-old, college-educated, college graduate, had a degree in communications. The detectives approached him, asked him if he had a moment to talk. The defendant voluntarily produced his identification and ticket. He was asked if he would accompany them to a room a few feet away. He was asked if he would consent to the search. The defendant produced a key for one bag and said it was all right.
The difficulty with that submission is that the state courts found that he was detained against his will. They found he was arrested.
The state court certainly did, but...
Must we overturn that to relieve you of this judgment?
The panel decision in the trial court did not find that he was arrested, Your Honor. What we're asking the court to do is reinstate the panel decision and the trial court's finding.
Well, I know, but we have to disagree with the Florida Court of Appeals.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think
they made a finding based on the record, I guess.
They made a finding based upon the fact that his luggage had been detained.
Well, whatever it was, you do say turn that conclusion over.
This was in no means an arrest, Your Honor. Well, that's what the Florida Florida Third District en banc held, that it was an arrest.
What precisely does the holding that something was an arrest mean? Is that basically a factual issue or a legal issue, or is mixed question of fact and law?
I think it's a mixed question based upon the facts presented. We would submit to you.
Does it imply a determination by whoever's making the finding that subjectively the person felt he was not free to go, or that objectively a reasonable person in his position would not have felt free to go? Or which of those two?
I think objectively the reasonable person innocent of crime is the standard which this court is articulating. In particular, Your Honor, the defendant himself said in the room that he was not under arrest. And I think that totally belies the Third District Court of Appeals' conclusion that he was under arrest. In particular, we would point to the fact that the numerous reasons announced by the Third District Court of Appeal as reasons for the arrest were not thought of or dreamed up by anybody in the trial court. In fact, the argument in the motion to suppress, the defendant said he did what he did because they were police officers. That's the only reason he offered whatsoever. He offered no other reason for the detention, which he claimed. We are here years later arguing matters which the trier of fact, the defendant, and the police officers never thought of.
But Mr. Fox, just to interrupt for a moment, what is the court that we should look to for the facts, the trial court or the appellate court? It's a state court, and I suppose we have a limited right to disagree with them on the facts. And the appellate court did say he was, in fact, not free to leave. They said that unequivocally.
The en banc court?
Yeah.
Aren't we
bound by that?
No, Your Honor. I think the record in the trial court is what we're bound by here as a matter of fact. I think there was another thing that was determined by the Third District Court of Appeal en banc. They kept calling it the police room.
What standard of review do we follow in deciding whether or not the state appellate court was wrong in disagreeing with the state trial court on the facts? Is it clearly erroneous or substantial evidence? Or what is the standard we should apply?
I think that if there's substantial evidence in the trial court for the trial court to have reached the conclusion that this was a voluntary transaction, that must be flagrantly erroneous. It must be clearly erroneous, and must be a substantial departure from the constitutional law of this court.
Well, why must the state appellate court have some standard about overruling its trial court's What standard does the Constitution require? Here, surely the Florida appellate court overruled the district court.
Well, that's...
It may be that if it applied the wrong legal standard in adjudicating the federal constitutional question, we could certainly correct that. And even if it didn't apply the right standard, we could disagree with it if it's a mixed question of fact and law.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we have argued vigorously in our brief that the standard here is, as this Court found in Mendenhall, is that the Circuit Court of Appeal was totally mistaken in substituting its judgment for that of the trier of fact as to the issues of fact before the trial court. And that's
did the Court of Appeals of Florida have anything before it that we haven't before us in this case now?
No, Your Honor.
Well, didn't it have a concession that the state made at the oral argument before that court, which they refer to, that the state conceded at oral argument that the officers would not have permitted Royer to leave? We don't have that before us, but they had it before them.
You have my offer in the brief, Your Honor, that in fact, after an extensive argument with Judge Schwartz, I stated to him that in fact, I wasn't there. I don't know what the officers would have done.
So you're telling us there was no such concession?
There was a concession, but the concession was qualified in a certain context, and that context was that, in fact,
I'm suggesting to you is we have something different before us than they had before them. They heard your argument there. We didn't.
Yes, Your Honor, they do. They did, but I don't think the concession is a dispositive issue in this case.
Why not?
I think that the officers would not have let him leave, Your Honor. I don't think that is speculating what they might have done is not the issue. The question is, what did they do?
And the issue, and you think the issue was what a reasonable person would have thought about whether he was free to leave?
Innocent of
crime.
The
officers may have subjectively decided in their own mind, we'll never let him go. But a reasonable person might have thought that he was free to go. Is that your argument?
Certainly it could be a voluntary transaction, irrespective as to the officer's intent in the case. They proceeded on the basis that it was a voluntary transaction. And, Your Honors, I think at the point where the defendant said, no, I don't want to give you consent to look in my suitcase, and I want to leave, I think that circumstance is a different circumstance than what transpired here. At that point, the officers would have had to make a decision as to whether or not they could detain the defendant within the meaning of the Constitution. But they never reached that point. That's why my concession, which is put in the footnote in the Third District Court of Appeal, if we accept the concession as it's stated facially, which I say it's absolutely incorrect and not in proper context, that concession does not affect the outcome here. The question is what the record shows as to what transpired
reason we disregard this finding of the court that you did make the concession is that you deny it here.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct.
Well, what else do we have?
I have only offered my statement of the context of that remark. That is, I stated if the defendant had refused consent, then
the
officer...
What other reason do you have for us to disregard it?
Because it's not relevant to determination of the constitutional issues here, Your Honor.
To do with anything here. He can't make evidence one way or the other.
But the en banc court did find that the defendant was under the reasonable impression that he was not free to leave. Not just a subjective impression, but on the objective facts, he was under a reasonable impression that he was not free to leave. So that we just, in order to find for you, we must disagree with that mixed question of law and fact.
My analysis of the Third District Court of Appeal decision is that the in-bank decision, that is, that they flatly decided that because his luggage had been detained and that because his ticket was still in the possession of Johnson, that in fact those factors created a situation where he was not free to leave
as a matter
of law.
But he was under the reasonable, as a matter of law, he was under the reasonable impression he was not free to leave. That's
flatly,
what they said.
Flatly because of those factors.
Well, Mr. Fox, could you turn to if you have it before you, page 49 of the supplemental appendix, which I think contains the opinion of the D.C., or perhaps you're familiar enough. I just wanted to read you one sentence, which I think is what the D.C.A. said about this thing. Do you call them D.C.A.s in Florida?
Yes, Your Honor. District Court of Appeal.
The court said, applying the test adopted in Frost, it is obvious that Royer, as he himself testified, was, quote, under the reasonable impression that he was not free to leave the officer's presence, close quote. And then I guess it's a cite to the Frost opinion. Now, why do they incorporate the test adopted in Frost with what would otherwise appear to be pretty much a factual finding? Did Frost say something about the when you would find that someone was under a reasonable impression?
Frost went off and said, as a matter of law, when you keep a defendant's ticket, he's absolutely detained.
So they were simply applying Frost?
They were applying
to this situation.
That ruling in Frost. Now, Frost went on and made a number of other rulings, but they were applying that. That is the single factor which they say, as a matter of law, you're detained. Now, that conflicts with Elmore, and Elmore just flatly says, just because the officer's got the ticket does not mean you're detained. You're not detained until he leaves your presence with that ticket. And Elmore is the leading case in the Fifth Circuit, and Frost absolutely disregarded and severely criticized the Elmore court, which was brought to its attention. That holding was brought to its attention. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Fry.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case has several issues in it that are of great importance doctrinally to Fourth Amendment law and to federal law enforcement. If you analyze the sequence of events that arose here, you begin with the initial contact between the agents and Mr. Royer, and there is an issue whether at that point you had a seizure of his person within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment or simply a contact not regulated by the Fourth Amendment. That issue is important because if you had a seizure, you can consider in the effort to justify that seizure only the facts known to the agents at the time they first approached Mr. Royer and not facts that they learned during the initial interview with him. Now, when the situs of the transaction moved from the concourse to the office nearby, you have a question whether that movement was either fully voluntary and not subject to the Fourth Amendment, as was said in Mendenhall, or a continuation of an investigative detention or an arrest requiring probable cause. Now, I'd like to turn first to the arrest issue because I believe that is what the state court rested on. There is, of course, a final issue as to whether the consent to the search of the suitcases was voluntary. I won't address that. I don't think it was decided by the lower court. The rationale of the lower court was a fruits rationale that even if the consent was voluntary, it was the product of an antecedent illegal seizure of Mr. Royer's person. Now, I think it is crystal clear that the lower court used the wrong test in identifying whether Mr. Royer was under arrest at the time he was moved to the office and the consent was secured.
You're talking about the Court of Appeals?
The District Court of Appeal, yes.
En banc.
En banc. Mm-hmm. The opinion that's under review here. Mm-hmm. That opinion suggests that the criterion for determining whether there was an arrest requiring probable cause is whether the suspect was free to leave. As we've indicated in
the brief. I thought they said whether he reasonably believed he was free to leave.
He reasonably believed he was free to leave.
Well, that's quite different. That's quite different.
Well, not to my point, but I absolutely agree that the test is an objective one and not his subjective belief or the subjective intentions of the officer. But the point that I'm making here is that the test of free to leave is a test that distinguishes not arrests from non-arrests, but Fourth Amendment seizures from non-seizures. And it's well settled that Fourth Amendment seizures consists of two kinds of things, a Terry-type investigative detention or an arrest. One can be based on reasonable suspicion, not amounting to probable cause. The latter requires probable cause. Now, in deciding whether what happened here was an arrest, it seems to me that it strains the English language and the logical structure of Fourth Amendment analysis to call this an arrest. If you view these events as occurring to an innocent traveler who has mistakenly been seized upon as a possible drug courier by the agents, it would be quite clear to that person that he had not yet been arrested, that he was being detained for a brief course of investigation, which would result in his release if he knew he was innocent after the officers looked in the luggage. that did not have the indicia of duration. If you compare it to Dunaway, you're talking about moving him a number of miles to the police station, keeping him for an indefinite period until he confessed. From the standpoint of Mr. Dunaway, even if he were innocent, he would have perceived what happened to him, I think, quite clearly as being having the essential attributes of a formal arrest, which is the language the court used last term in Michigan against Summers. Now, it's important, in our view, not to place undue emphasis in defining an arrest on the factors that the lower court here, the en banc court, relied upon, which is movement or a detention or extended custody beyond a momentary stop, because those factors may arise in many contexts where we believe that they can be legitimately done as part of an investigative detention. For instance, the detention of a suspected robber near the scene of the robbery and the question whether he could be moved, let's say, a block to the scene of the robbery for purposes of a show-up without having probable cause. Now, let me say finally on the arrest issue that if you don't say this is not an arrest, that does not leave the subject of investigative detentions unregulated under the Fourth Amendment. An investigative detention, like an arrest, must be reasonable. And you have the ability to say in this case that the detention under the circumstances may have been unreasonable, but calling it an arrest, I think, would be most unfortunate.
Mr. Fry, may I just ask you one question? You say the court used the wrong test in the free-to-leave business for an arrest. How would you phrase the test of an arrest?
Well, I think that is a difficult question. We know what a formal arrest is, but I think...
If that's the wrong test, you ought to know what the right test is.
I don't have to. I can know what it isn't when I don't see
but
it.
But you don't have something...
Without knowing necessarily exactly.
You don't have a test to propose to us that's better.
Well, I think what you would look at is the duration and the reasonable understanding of the individual as to whether he is likely to be charged with a crime or held for an indefinite period until he's presented
well,
to a judicial
under that
officer.
Test, if one believed the testimony that the men said, he must have thought he was going to be charged with a crime.
He couldn't have thought. I think it's very important that you look at it from the perspective of an innocent person, because the purpose of these rules is to protect against innocent people being mistakenly seized upon and imposed upon by police officers.
And so an innocent person who is just patient and knows if he waits out several hours, say, in the room, he knows he'll get free eventually. Is
well,
that enough?
The purpose of what occurred here, which took about 10 to 15 minutes, was to secure his consent and then carry out, on the basis of his consent, the examination of his luggage. If it had turned up nothing, he clearly would have been released.
The arrest turns on what happens after the investigation is over.
But the suspect would know what would happen, that is, that he would give his consent. There's nothing in this situation.
In other words, you're backing into a corner where it's the suspect's state of mind that determines whether the officer's conduct constitutes an arrest, as I understand.
It's not his subjective
state
of mind. It's what a reasonable person in his situation would perceive based on the officer's conduct.
You apparently agree that there was a seizure then.
Well,
at least you say that if you accept the reason, the trial court's or the court of appeals finding, at least there was a seizure. There may not have been an arrest.
Well, let me say this. We strongly disagree that there was a seizure at the point of initial contact.
Well, all right. But you do agree that at least it's the right test for the seizure.
The test for whether there's a seizure is whether the person reasonably believes that he's free to leave.
That's the right test for a seizure.
And in the circumstance, I think it's very important, in the circumstance in which there is no clarification either by a statement from the officer or an inquiry.
But you wouldn't think that even if there was a seizure here under the right test, and you haven't said there wasn't yet, you wouldn't think that would give the officers ipso facto the right to search his luggage.
Certainly not. Well,
no.
The search has to be based on a consent. The issue in this case is whether the consent was the fruit of an illegal seizure. Our position is that if at the time they moved him to the office he had been seized, they had ample, reasonable suspicion.
Let's just assume everybody agreed there was a valid Terry stop. There's a quick frisk, and the fellow says, I want to ask you a question. May I search your luggage? The fellow says, sure. And right on the spot, right then, in 30 seconds, the luggage is searched. You say that A, there is a seizure, but B, it's a completely consensual search. That's your...
The search would have to be consensual in this case.
Yeah, and your only difference is that they instead of searching him on the spot, they moved him into another room.
We're saying that that does not convert what would otherwise be a valid...
But it certainly extends the seizure, doesn't it?
It is a somewhat extended seizure beyond...
And have we ever approved that kind of a seizure?
Michigan against Mendenhall. Summers.
And Summers?
Michigan against Summers. Not really in Mendenhall, because Mendenhall rested on a consent rationale. But in Summers, quite clearly, there was an extended seizure of, I think, quite considerably longer duration than this, which involved moving him a distance equal, I assume, to the distance that he was moved in this case. So I don't
yes,
think those...
Yes, but that was a... That was
not free to leave.
That was the incident to the issuance of a... Some of a warrant.
But the court's discussion.
And here's
first,
a person came out of the house that was about to be searched.
I understand, but if you look at the court's analysis, the court begins by creating an analytical framework within which the issue is to be decided.
Well, there's nothing like that here.
We have exactly like that. We have a reasonable suspicion justifying an investigative detention.
We don't have any cases justifying this long of an investigative detention.
Well, I'm not sure what that... I think that the detention in Summers was investigative. They were... The execution of the warrant was an investigation. And it was an investigation which is...
It was at least authorized by a warrant, which is the
whole
argument
nothing in the
here,
warrant that
there
authorized...
was no warrant for the searching of the luggage.
Well, the warrant did not authorize the detention of Summers. I see my time has expired.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Mr. Royer was walking in the airport. He was stopped by the police, told them that they suspect him of carrying drugs. He's moved into a converted storage closet. They keep his tickets. They get his bags without his consent. He's told by the police that they would like to look in his bags to either confirm or dispel their suspicions, and he opens the bag. Under those circumstances,
when you say he,
the officer opens the bags.
With the consent of your client?
No, Your Honor. We do not contend that there was any consent whatsoever in this case.
How did he get the key?
Your Honor, the exact words of the agent when questioned about this issue of consent was, we told him we suspected him of carrying narcotics, and we asked him to open the bags to either confirm or dispel our suspicions. Mr. Royer, without saying a word, took his key out of the bag, out of his pocket, opened the bag, unlocked it, and then the officer actually did the opening of the bag.
And you say that was not voluntary?
Pardon me?
You say that
we
was
say
not...
that it was not voluntary, Your Honor. We say our position basically under these circumstances is
don't you think
that...
he could have said, you can open my bag when you get a warrant?
Your Honor, he could have said very many things.
Well,
he could have said
yes,
a number of things.
I'm just posing one to you.
Pardon me?
I'm just posing one hypothetical, not many.
All right, Your Honor. If he had said that, then I think that there would be no consent at all if he said, you can open my bags when you get a warrant. I think that would be quite clear that there would be no consent whatsoever under
and then
those
we don't know what would have happened, whether he would have been detained while he went to get a warrant or whether they would have opened it without a warrant.
Your Honor, we can go on the basis of either the state's concession at oral argument or if they
concession isn't evidence in a case.
No, Your Honor, but I think that the state's argument that is set forth in their reply brief points out specifically on page 9, they said what would have happened after that is that certainly in that event, the officers could have readily sought other means of gathering information, including the use of a trained narcotics dog. So I think that their basic argument is that irrespective of whether or not the consent was ultimately granted, then this individual was not going anywhere until the police had completed their investigation. Now, we maintain that either this situation represents the most expansive Terry stop that has ever been recognized and possibly the most coercive consent that could ever be validated, or as we say, that it was an illegal arrest, and regardless of the nomenclature, it was tantamount to an arrest.
Mr. Klein,
yes, Your Honor.
At what point in time did the arrest become illegal?
Your Honor, it's impossible to say at the precise moment when it occurred.
Do you agree there was reasonable suspicion to ask questions?
Your Honor, I would concede that there was reasonable suspicion for the officers to approach the defendant in the airport and to engage in a contact. and nothing more.
What do you mean by contact?
A contact is a voluntary encounter, and as the court pointed out in the footnotes in Terry and all of its progeny, it's a voluntary encounter. The police are not isolated from citizenry. They are permitted to talk to them and to go and engage and to see whether or not there is something that arouses their suspicions any further.
So there was a limited Terry-type stop or seizure. Up to what point?
Your Honor, we maintain that there was a limited encounter that took place in the form of the conversation. And then beyond that, I think that it's unreasonable to say that anybody who is approached by officers in a public place, regardless of whether they're guilty or they're innocent, and the standard is an innocent person, we maintain that an innocent person who is asked by officers to please show him show his driver's license and his ticket,
the conversation became unlawful at the moment the request was made to see the driver's license?
Your Honor, we maintain that at the point that he was asked for his driver's license and his ticket, at that juncture, a reasonable person would not feel that they were free to walk away. It is natural for an individual, whether they're guilty or they're innocent, when they're approached by a police officer, to produce those documents.
Mr. Klein, in the Summers decision that has been mentioned, perfectly clear that the individual there was not free to walk away.
Yes, Your Honor.
The rationale of that case, as I understood it, was that under circumstances that create a reasonable suspicion, the officers may detain an individual for a period of time.
Your Honor?
Do you agree with that or not?
Your Honor, Michigan versus Summers was a highly limited situation. I think that the underlying rationale there was that the issue of probable cause had already been submitted to a neutral, detached magistrate.
Probable cause to detain the individual outside of his home?
No, Your Honor. It was probable cause for the search of the house. And under those circumstances, a limited seizure detention of the individual was appropriate in order to ascertain if there was going to be any evidence that was turned up in the house. But I don't think the Michigan versus Summers reflects the proper model for determination of the issues
here. And who was the person detained in Michigan?
It was the owner of the house.
And that house was covered by a search warrant.
That's correct. And that was really the underlying rationale, that a neutral detached magistrate had issued a search warrant. And I think the court made it quite clear that function should be served by someone in that position rather than those who are on the front line, such as police, who are often engaged in the competitive aspects of ferreting out crime.
Refresh my recollection, Mr. Klein. Did the court in Sumner rely on Terry? That was my recollection.
Your Honor, it was a Terry extension.
A Terry-type limited seizure was my recollection.
Your Honor, it was a Terry-type limited seizure.
Right.
But it was based upon the rationale of a neutral magistrate already having secured a warrant. And I think that that's the way that that can be justified under those circumstances. And it was justified on the basis that it was necessary in order to determine whether or not there was any individual or any proof that might turn up during the course of the search itself, which is far more intrusive in and of itself than the seizure of the individual. Now, what our position is that whatever Terry stop may have been justified in the first instance in this matter became increasingly more custodial and ultimately culminated in an illegal arrest. The traditional dividing point has always been, of course, probable cause. The Terry case recognized an intermediate step which was limited in nature and in purpose. It is between a contact and an arrest. Articulable suspicion permits a limited seizure of the person, but it must be done with the clear caveat that whatever intrusion takes place pursuant to this seizure must be limited to that which made its initiation permissible in the first place. So that asking a seized driver to get out of his car for the immediate safety of the officer has been upheld. A pat-down, as in Terry, has been upheld. Fuentes Martinez, border stop, inquiring with reference to immigration status has been upheld. But none of those cases, and none of the Terry line of cases, have expanded the intermediate step to the extreme here without either requiring probable cause or calling it an arrest. So therefore, the real question is what happened here up to the actual point of the search of the luggage? Can it be justified as a Terry stop? Now, first of all, I think it's important to distinguish this case from the Mendenhall.
Could I ask you what I ask your colleague?
Yes, Your Honor.
A voluntary stop, even you would say that a voluntary stop. Quick pat down and one question. Mm-hmm. May I search your luggage? Man says yes. Luggage is searched. Wouldn't the only question be the question of whether the consent was voluntary? You wouldn't say...
I would have no problem with that.
And you wouldn't say that just because there was a seizure, a momentary seizure under Terry, that his consent to search would be an invalid fruit.
I would have no problem with that whatsoever.
And you think that, let's assume there was a voluntary stop here initially. Just assume that.
Yes, Your Honor.
If they had then asked him, may we search your luggage, and he said yes, and they had searched it right on the spot, no problem.
I have no problem with that whatsoever.
It's just the movement into the other room?
Even under certain circumstances, a movement may be appropriate. But it was a combination of factors here.
A movement could be a lot less embarrassing.
Your Honor, that's true. But if that's the case, then every time that the police conduct a so-called Terry stop and they want to avoid embarrassment to the subject of the Terry stop, that would, in their rationale, permit them to move him off to some isolated place.
And then what?
And then conduct whatever it is that they want to do.
Is it just the lapse of time, or is it the change of atmosphere which makes it reasonable for somebody to think that he's still being detained?
Well, Your Honor, the lapse of time is only one factor, and I don't think that it's critical in this case. The lapse of time has been held to be a long time to be reasonable. In Michigan versus Summers, 2 hours was reasonable.
Let's concede there was an initial seizure, like as in my example.
Yes.
Terry stop and seizure. And then he's just moved somewhere, and they ask him, may we search your luggage? He says yes. That consent then is bad, although it wouldn't have been...
I'm sorry, I didn't...
A voluntary stop initially?
Your Honor.
A seizure, and they take him away to another place, and 5 minutes later they ask him, may we search your luggage? He says yes. You think that's necessarily a fruit of an arrest?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow the question. If there's an initial Terry stop...
If he can consent to searching his luggage initially...
Yes, Your Honor.
...under a valid stop, why can't he validly consent to it 5 minutes later?
He could, if the circumstances were right. Well, if they hadn't engaged in any more coercive conduct...
Like what?
Like taking his ticket, as they did here, like going and getting his bags and putting them in the room, isolating him, as they did here, advising him, now we suspect you, under these circumstances, of... carrying narcotics. We'd like you to open the bag
and
to see whether or not there's anything in there.
And that makes it more likely that he would consent to searching his bag?
I think it would, Your Honor. I think that placing him in that kind of a coercive atmosphere makes it more likely. I think it's unreasonable after an individual such as this has been removed to a room, they've got his bags, they've got his tickets, they tell him, now we suspect you of carrying narcotics, and we'd like you to open up the bag in order to confirm or dispel our suspicions. I think it's unreasonable to think that anybody, guilty or innocent, can simply say, well, I've had quite enough of this, gentlemen. I've got to go on my way.
Is your conclusion then that his consent is coerced or that there is an arrest and a fruit of an invalid arrest? That's a completely different thing.
It's both. I haven't
gotten
to the
consent. Well, you don't need to get to the arrest then. It's just a
we don't have to.
It's just a coerced consent.
I believe that it is. I think that would be the easiest way to decide this, is that this was a coerced consent under the circumstances, and regardless of whether or not we call it an arrest or not, it's a clear confinement which exceeds the scope.
The court below didn't decide that.
Your Honor.
The court below said there was an arrest and a fruit of an invalid arrest.
Your Honor, I think that the exact...
Isn't that what it said?
Your Honor, I think that the exact holding of the
court...
Well,
they said there was an arrest.
They said that regardless of the exact nomenclature employed to describe the situation,
well, where are you reading from in the supplemental appendix?
I don't have a supplemental appendix. I'm reading under the section that is consent invalid. And then it says, Royer involuntarily confined is the first section, and then the second section, number two, it's page 50.
No probable cause.
Pardon me? That's what, correct. The section
all right,
says no probable
Royer
cause.
Royer has been placed under arrest. No probable cause.
Yes, Your Honor. It says, for all practical purposes, he had been placed under arrest when the alleged consent was given. The exact nomenclature employed to describe the situation is, however, unimportant. I don't think that the term arrest should be dispositive of the situation because of his precise situation.
But we've held that even so-called voluntary consents after or voluntary statements after an invalid arrest are still fruits
and
inadmissible.
Yes.
Without finding them coerced.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what's your submission here? Is that the consent was coerced and therefore invalid?
Your Honor, the consent, there was no consent, is our position, and therefore invalid. But irrespective of that, it was a Terry stop that exceeded the scope of what is reasonably necessary.
And thereupon became an arrest.
Yes, Your Honor, it did. And in connection with that, the court's inquiry of the government as to when a seizure becomes an arrest, and the government was unable to come up with a clear definition. Well, I like the definition that the government itself gave. And that was in their brief in this case. They advert to their brief in the Michigan versus Summers case. And on page 10, they point out in their brief that after saying that Dunaway made it clear that the formal label is not dispositive, that probable cause is required whenever there is a sufficiently substantial invasion of the suspect's freedom of movement. What constitutes a sufficiently substantial deprivation of liberty to require probable cause remains to be fleshed out. If, however, a detention is deemed to be of sufficient severity to fall within this category, its lawfulness will not be evaluated by reference to a general reasonable analysis, but will ordinarily depend solely upon the existence of probable cause. That's what we have here, Your Honor. I maintain that the Terry stop exceeded the initial reason for the intrusion. It was unnecessary to expand it to the point that it was. It was unnecessary under these circumstances and therefore constitutionally unreasonable.
You have indicated that you thought the initial stop was perfectly valid, the stop and the inquiry. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, it was about roughly 15 steps from where they then stood to the room. At what point did you say he became under arrest?
Your
First
Honor.
Step, fifth step, tenth step?
No, Your Honor. I would say that by the time he was asked for his consent, he was under arrest. And I think that it's impossible to single out any of those crucial elements that I have adverted to. And the court, the Florida court, the appeals court, did not try to distinguish between those crucial elements. And I think that the government is incorrect when they say that the sole basis of the Florida court's position about an illegal arrest was based upon his the reasonable apprehension that he was not free to go. That was merely one of the factors that the Florida court adverted to in making its ultimate determination that an arrest had occurred. It specifically cited the other instances of misconduct indicating that the man was not free to go, such as the and that he was in effect in a classic case of imprisonment.
As part of, you haven't argued, unless I missed it, that there was not even any grounds for a voluntary stop here.
No, Your Honor, I have not as yet, but I'll be glad to address that point.
Well, that is part of your submission, I take
it. Yes, Your Honor, and on that particular point, what our problem is that this Terry stop was based upon the so-called profile, drug courier profile, and the government has submitted in their orange book to the court a compilation of the law and the cases. And they point out, for one thing, that there is no national profile. And the reason for this is that a perusal of the cases that they have in their book shows that all of the elements are contradictory. In one case, it's the last passenger off the plane. The next time, it's the first passenger. No bags, heavy bags or empty bags. Walking very fast, very slow. A one-way ticket. A round-trip ticket.
They're always nervous.
They're always not always. Sometimes nervousness seems to be a factor in Atlanta, but not necessarily in Los Angeles. And
what point are you trying to make?
Pardon me?
What point are you trying to make?
The point that I'm trying to make is that it's very much like analyzing why the stock market has gone up the previous day. It permits the police to take what is essentially a hunch. They select out the factors that fit. They give it a label, and they mask what is essentially a hunch, an essentially arbitrary action.
What's arbitrary about following a hunch?
I mean, there's nothing.
I personally am not persuaded that police officers enjoy running around after red herrings or running after people who really aren't going to provide any leads or clues. Shouldn't the courts give some deference in this situation to the considered experience of law enforcement personnel just on the basis that they're the ones on the scene and probably know a little bit more about it than we do?
Your Honor, in some instances that's true. First of all, though, we're dealing with a particular case. And here, this case, the officer had all of 1 month experience. He had been on the job since November.
Well, but the profile was presumably devised by people other than him.
All right. Yes,
Your Honor. So what does the 1 month experience have to do with it?
All right, Your Honor, because we're talking about what essentially must be individualized suspicion. And the perfect example here is that some of the characteristics that were adverted to by the officer in his testimony as to why he suspected this person was because he was carrying American Tourister luggage. He said he was carrying one old suitcase, one new suitcase, and he put them up near the counter, and most people carry their luggage with them. Now, the profile has its place. It is an excellent administrative tool for the police to use to single out possible suspicious activity for further investigation, but it should not be used as a justification for intruding on the Fourth Amendment.
Why not?
Because the fact of being part of a profile in and of itself should not be used in connection with a Terry stop as a substitute for individualized suspicion. And I think every case since Terry has talked about individualized suspicion as to why it was that a particular element in the profile was or was not.
Well, supposing the government could produce evidence, which I take it hasn't here, that of each of these elements in the profile, when they were run down, 70% of the follow-ups indicated a person who was probably guilty of some offense and 30% didn't. Now, would you say that an officer couldn't simply apply that profile across the board if it was documented in that way without making any further individualized determination?
I still think that he needs to make an individualized determination in every instance. Statistical approach.
Well, what if the individualized determination he makes was that this person whom I'm following now exhibits 8 of the 10 characteristics that the profile says to look for, and each of those 10 characteristics is documented by experience?
I still think, Your Honor, under those circumstances, that he has to be able to articulate whether or why any particular item of behavior, regardless of whether it's on or off the profile.
Any particular item or the combination of all of them?
He can use a combination of all of them, but he still must articulate why it is that he believes that these things lead him to suspect that a crime is being committed.
Well, why not past experience? If 80% of the follow-ups in the past of people with a particular kind of luggage have indicated that you find a guilty person, why isn't that a perfectly adequate basis of using that in the case of the next person that comes along?
Your Honor, I still think that under those circumstances that there has got to be some showing that in this particular case that they suspect him of a crime, because each of those things are innocent in and of themselves.
Well, of course, but that's the very fallacious approach of the undistributed middle, which really doesn't mean anything in this kind of situation, I think. You keep referring to what you think and what you believe.
Yes, Your Honor.
What cases from this court support your view that a profile of this sort is not usable in any circumstances?
Your Honor, I think that the concurring opinion in the Mendenhall case, in footnote number 6, Justice Powell specifically indicated that a mere profile match in and of itself would not be a substitute for that sort of individualized suspicion. Its appearance on the profile may or may not have significance. But the mere fact that it does appear on the profile cannot be used as a substitute to make the determination that, in fact, a suspicion of a crime has been committed. There still must be something that is articulated
Well,
as
on your
to
approach,
what,
on your approach, a profile has no use whatsoever.
No, I believe that it has a very, very useful approach to single out from the very large universe of people those whom there is some unusual activity that would cause the police then to go and conduct a further inquiry.
And it worked pretty well here, didn't it?
Pardon me?
It worked pretty well here.
Well, I think that we must look at things at the point prior to the search. Otherwise, we can't look at it afterwards as a bootstrapping sort of thing, because in every case in which there is a criminal case in which there's a motion to suppress, it means that it worked. But the determination still must be made prior to the actual
incursion. You were emphasizing the individual components here some time back.
Yes, Your Honor.
It turned out that one of these suitcases had weighed 65 pounds.
No, there were 65 together, Your Honor.
Together?
It was an aggregate. Yes.
That's quite a lot for two suitcases of the size indicated by this record.
They were heavy suitcases, Your Honor. There's no doubt about it. But the fact that somebody is carrying heavy suitcases does not give one the kind of articulable suspicion that a crime is being committed.
Not standing alone.
Pardon me?
Not standing alone, but it's one of the factors
Your Honor,
you concede.
It is a factor, but it still does not show why a crime has been committed. The fact that it's American Tourister or that it's a heavy suitcase, the fact that that the person looked nervous, and by the way, there's a case that said that pointed out as one of the characteristics that the defendant looked very calm. So, again, there's a contradiction to every single one of these items that occur.
Then I say again that in your position, profile is perfectly useless.
No, I believe that it's very useful for the police to go and to make the initial contact so that they don't have to just select people out at random to see whether or not they're drug couriers in an airport. And at that point, then, they would go and make their contact. Now, if the state and the government are fearful of a person getting away with crime, the police don't have to shrug their shoulders and simply walk away. They can still limit the intrusion to the reason within the Terry standards.
Well, I don't. You're not suggesting that they have to have reasonable suspicion to go up and ask a fellow.
No, I'm not suggesting that at all, Your
Honor.
You know, they could do it at
let's
random.
Let's assume on these facts you applied the rationale of the plurality in Mendenhall.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where would you be then?
I'm sorry. I didn't
understand. Justice Stewart's opinion in Mendenhall.
Yes, Your Honor.
Apply that to this case.
If we applied that to this case, then there would be no seizure at all in the first instance. But
the facts aren't really different from Mendenhall, are they?
Yes, Your Honor, they are.
And how? Why was there more of a seizure here than there was in Mendenhall?
First of all, the ticket was handed back in Mendenhall. The trial court made a specific finding in Mendenhall that Mrs. Mendenhall had agreed to go to the room in a spirit of cooperation. She was never told
That's a finding. I'm talking about the facts.
All right. She was never told either out in the concourse or in the office that she was suspected of carrying narcotics, so that there's a focus issue that's involved there. There was no retrieval of her luggage.
Well,
she was advised in the room of her right to refuse.
Let's assume there was no reasonable suspicion in this case. There was just the profile, and assume we agreed with you that doesn't amount to reasonable suspicion, but nevertheless, it did sort this person out.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you go up to him and you say, may I ask you some questions? We're narcotics officers and we suspect you of carrying narcotics. We want to ask you one question. May we search your luggage? And he says, yes.
Again, if that took place out in the concourse, I would have no problem with it. And in fact, I think
next question.
Yes.
He goes up to him, we're narcotics officers. We suspect you of carrying narcotics, but we have no articulatable suspicion about that. One question. Will you come over and let us search your luggage in this room over here? And he says yes.
Your Honor, now we're beginning to build hypotheses that I can't answer because I think that it may or may not be.
He doesn't say. Now they just say, will you come over to this room? And he says yes. And he gets over there and says, may we search your luggage?
Then we're closer to a Mendenhall
Justice
situation.
Justice Stewart said that's just complete consent all the way down. No seizure, no nothing.
Your Honor, then we perhaps would get closer to a Mendenhall situation, but that's not the situation that we have here. And I think, again, in order to determine...
One of the government's argument is that it is, isn't it?
Your Honor, that's correct. But I think in order to determine these issues of the scope of a Terry seizure, that We've got to go back and look at the Terry Polestars and see what it is that is sought to be accomplished. And one of the things that must be determined is how far we can extend this Terry stop without running afoul of the original principle. The whole object of all of the Terry cases, including the investigative stop cases, is that the scope of the intrusion must be limited to the reason for the initial seizure. And that's what justified the Terry rationale in the first place. Now, if we limit that under these circumstances to the Terry seizure, then I think it's clear that whatever occurs should occur out there in the concourse. It's constitutionally unreasonable to take all the steps.
Why should the test of a seizure be what the CZ reasonably thought about whether he was free to go or not?
Why should it be?
Yeah, because on that basis, you probably will never be never permit the police to go up to anybody and say, "May I ask you a question?"
Your Honor, I agree, but that's what the court has said, but that's the test. And
why shouldn't it rest on some act of compulsion or show of force by the police?
Your Honor, the cases have said the question is whether or not the CZ, quote unquote, is under the reasonable belief that he was not free to walk away. I think it's a very, very difficult rationale to apply, but nevertheless, that is the standard that this court has adopted.
In what case?
Your Honor, I think that it's a number of cases that follow Terry, and I think that I can't recall exactly which of those cases, but the question has always been stated under whether or not the CZ.
In one case, have five justices agreed to that?
It was Justice Stewart's opinion, joined by one other justice in Mendenhall.
All right. My own feeling is that that's an unworkable standard. That it ought to be a standard as to whether or not some act is done by the police officer that would reasonably indicate that the defendant was not free to go, not the subjective standard of what was in the defendant's mind, because that's an impossible standard to apply. And I think that looking at it from the standpoint of the law enforcement authorities rather than from the subjective standard of the defendant makes a lot more sense. And looking at it from that standard, if a police officer asks an individual on the street or anywhere, "Can I see your license?" it is unreasonable to believe that the person thinks that he can freely walk away without giving up his license or without arousing further suspicion.
Well, there's one way to find out, and that's by saying no.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, we're talking about what would happen afterwards on the basis of a hypothetical. Now, if the state and the government are fearful of a person in Mr. Royer's position getting away with a crime, the police do not have to shrug their shoulders and walk away. They can still limit the intrusion to the reason within the Terry standards and yet carry on with a number of efficacious techniques. They can continue the brief seizure on the spot. They can continue the questioning. They can ask there if he would consent. They can check with the ticket agent. They can do a dog sniff of his luggage.
They continue the question?
Pardon
how
me?
Long can they continue the question?
How long? Your Honor, I think that the standard just has to be one of whether or not it's reasonable. And I don't think that they can.
Can they retain the man's ticket while they do the questioning, in your view?
Your Honor, if it's a seizure on the spot, I think that they could retain his ticket. That would be a means of holding him on a leash, because if there is a proper Terry seizure in the first instance, then I would think that under those circumstances it would be reasonable to hold their ticket while they're questioning him on the spot. But if they're going to attempt to remove him to some other place, then in order to expand that, they've got to have some legitimate reason why it's necessary to go to another place other than the general law enforcement objectives.
Do I understand you to say then that if they had asked him in the terminal rather than in the office to open the bags, you'd have no objection?
I think that that would be appropriate under those circumstances. They can ask for a consent there, but it was merely the coercive elements that inhered in the situation in this instance. Also, they know, I started to give some reasons as to why it was that they could conduct it in another manner. He's getting on a plane for New York, so they know very well where he's going to be for the next 2.5 hours. And the agent testified in this case that he is in constant communication with agents in every other city throughout the country, checking on passengers coming and going in these instances. So it's very easy for them to do what they have to do.
The logical result of what you say, that they could have required him to open his suitcases right on the spot in your
response
to Justice Stevens. But because it takes 15 steps to save him some public embarrassment, then they lose some rights?
Your Honor, it's not just the movement of the 15 steps. First of all, they put him into a converted storage closet. It could be 5 steps, but once they move behind the door, which is only 3 inches wide.
Closet. How big was the room, as long as you've defined it as a closet?
It was defined by the police as a converted storage closet. The Court of Appeals pointed out that the officer did testify, contrary to what the state says, that it was a police room. It was outfitted with a desk and 2 chairs, and it's impossible to say. There's nothing in the record.
Big closet. Big closet.
Pardon me?
Sizable closet for a desk and 2 chairs.
The
situation would be different in your view if it were as large as this courtroom.
Your Honor, I think that would be an element, but I don't think that it is dispositive at all. I think that the coercive elements that all combined in this case added up to the situation that existed here.
Well, let's assume that the officer said that we are hereby arrest you. And
it would be an illegal arrest.
Well, let's assume there was even probable cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they say, may we search your suitcase? And he says, yes. There's nothing wrong with that consent necessarily, is there?
I would say that there is, Your Honor.
Well,
I would say
not if there was probable cause.
If there was probable cause, if there was probable cause, no. I would say not.
Well,
under Schneckloth, it would be an acceptable. It would be an acceptable standard.
Even if the case turned on the voluntariness, it could be found completely voluntary.
That's correct, Your Honor. It could.
Very well, Mr. Fox. Do you have anything further?
Yes, Your Honor. I have some.
You have 6 minutes remaining.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. First of all, Your Honor, we certainly do not abandon any arguments raised in our extensive brief, including the good faith exception. I would like to address why the voluntariness issue in this court should be overturned. And that is this court's various holdings, and we quote United States versus Price, that a finding of consent should not be overturned unless it's clearly erroneous. The evidence in this case is not so overwhelming that either this court or the District Court of Appeal and Bank should overturn both the panel opinion and the trial court on the question of voluntariness. The defendant just stated that this was a police room and that these witnesses so testified. In fact, Johnson was asked, is that an official police room? No, it's a closet that has shelves on one end. Do you have any police paraphernalia whatsoever in that room? No, because it's an area that we really couldn't secure very well. The police room is something that the Third District called this room. It is not something that it was in fact. With respect to why the defendant was stopped and assuming the defendant was detained, when he was taken to the room, he was not detained because he had American Tourister luggage, Your Honors. He was detained because of numerous facts and circumstances, not the least of which included the profile as a written indication of the officer's experience, in particularly his efforts to avoid detection, as are observed by the officers, in particularly Johnson's observations of the defendant's counter-surveillance, if you will. Certainly normal airline passengers don't conduct counter-surveillance to see if they're being observed.
When did they discover that he was using a false name, or at least a different name?
The alias was discovered at the very moment of the initial contact with the defendant, Your Honor. And that alias, Elmore and Patino, cited in our brief, Elmore said it would be a failure of duty had the federal agents not detained Elmore at that point to investigate him further. Now, that's detained to investigate further, which, assuming this was a detention, that it was absolutely lawful under Elmore. Elmore also said, upon these facts, profile or no profile, the officers also had a right to ask the defendant if he would consent to the search of his luggage. Patino reached exactly a similar result. With respect to the test to be applied, Your Honors, there's a two-part test here that we've argued in our brief. First of all, Terry and Mendenhall held that there is no detention unless there's physical force or a show of authority, and neither one of those circumstances was present in this case. The second...
Didn't they say they were officers? Isn't that, they showed them a badge?
That's not a show of authority, Your Honor.
Well, what is it a show of?
It's a show of the officers not wanting to have a nervous courier react to the fact that he was about to be taken out in the Everglades and left in the trunk of an automobile. These officers identify themselves for that specific reason, that they that the courier realizes that he's not being trailed by somebody else.
You must not object to the word authority. You want to show them the authority to protect them.
You want to show them authority to,
you want to show them authority.
Alleviate their fear that somebody who is not lawful and who is a...
Do you want to show them authority or not?
It's not a show of authority. Merely identifying oneself as a police officer is not a show of authority.
How does an officer make a show of authority?
Pardon me?
How does an officer make a show of authority if he doesn't by identifying himself and showing his the authorization to act as an officer?
He does it by... announcing to the defendant, you stay here, some sort of announcement, some sort of indication to the defendant.
Open the baggage? Would that be a show of authority?
Merely a request to open the bag is not a show of authority, Your Honor. This court has so held in Schneckloth. If this court accepts that that announcement of identification is a show of authority, then we're out the window on the mere contact concept, which this court accepted in Mendenhall.
Your friend has conceded that they could have told him to open the bags immediately on the spot.
Yes, Your Honor. His whole thing apparently rests at this point on whether or not the movement to the room is some sort of detention.
Is that a show of authority or an exercise of authority?
No, Your Honor. I think it was merely a request.
Well, there still could be a difference between asking a person, may we search your luggage, and saying to him, stay right here, now open your luggage. We're officers.
Yes, Your
Honor.
That's an order. That's a different circumstance. Exactly. That is a show of authority. Now, well, the second part of
that's an exercise of coercion.
Stay right here. We're going to get a warrant. That certainly is an exercise.
Well, or saying, now open your luggage. We order you to open your luggage.
Assuming that had been held in the trial court, that would be an exercise of authority. Your Honor, there's a second part to our analysis here as to the test to be applied in this case, and that is there must be a balancing test between the public's interest in the compelling public interest in law enforcement and the de minimis intrusion which is present in this case. And we would urge this court to follow the balancing test as articulated in Michigan versus Summers.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.